So let's just take a moment to adjust our motivation for the afternoon. It's hard to believe we're at the final session. It seems like it went really quickly. So just find a comfortable meditation posture. We're just going to do 1 or 2 minutes of focusing on the breath and then just renewing our motivation, because I want to talk a little bit more about rejoicing and the immeasurable joy, and then we'll actually do a longer meditation working with that. So just take a minute or two to do some focused meditation on the breath. So in the morning session, we touched on joy and this idea of rejoicing. Sometimes it's really useful to start our session or practice, whatever we're doing, with some rejoicing. As I mentioned this morning, even to start your day with rejoicing. And to rejoice in this moment, this incredibly precious opportunity that we have, each one of us here with an interest in the Dharma, having attained this perfect life, having our mental faculties intact, we can examine and discriminate these teachings, come to understand them, integrate them into our minds. We have access to the teachings in ways, particularly in this part of the world, that we've never had before. Geshe Thupten Sherab, our Geshe back in New Mexico, says we could sometimes think of these as degenerate times, which is frequently what many of the great teachers say, but he says we're actually living in incredibly fortunate times because we have the Dharma so accessible. We can turn on a video and see His Holiness teach, or many great masters teach. We can find books very easily. We're in a culture where we're free to practice Buddhism. Many cultures, there isn't that freedom. So just feel your incredible good fortune to have this moment right now in this human life, studying the Dharma, working on your own mind so that you can benefit others. And feel great joy at this. When we rejoice, it's not just a thought. It should be a feeling in our hearts, a lightness, a delight. And then on the basis of that rejoicing in our current situation, we see that we have to use this life meaningfully, therefore. We have to make sure that as much of this life as possible, every moment, if possible, we use to help to awaken fully. We use to help us to be better qualified to benefit others. So hold that thought of bodhicitta, which we'll be talking about more today, this afternoon, thinking that you're here in order to work on yourself so that you can eventually attain Buddhahood and then lead all beings into that same state. Okay, so I think most of you were here this morning. A few perhaps weren't. So what we did, are there handouts still? Does everyone have a copy of the handouts? There's some in the tray there. If you don't have a copy, you might take one, because I'm going to be referring to that frequently throughout the remainder of today. So we finished more or less with compassion. In terms of that handout, I think we're now somewhere around page. Compassion started on the bottom of 3 and went all the way to the top of page 5. This was the third immeasurable, the first, of course, being immeasurable equanimity, which is this even-mindedness, this equal regard for all beings. The second one being immeasurable love, where we open our hearts, focusing on the happiness that others seek, as well as ourselves, because we start with ourselves, but having that sincere wish for all beings and ourselves to experience that happiness, to have all the causes of happiness. Which, by the way, the causes of happiness, we touched on it briefly, but, you know, they're all the positive things that we do, all the wholesome, beneficial things that we engage in, our thoughts, our speech, our actions, everything that we do that leads us in a path of virtue, a path of wholesome and beneficial activity. Whereas, of course, the causes of our suffering that we want to be free of in the next thought, that we touched on again this morning, immeasurable compassion, the causes of our suffering are all the negative states of mind, all the negative actions we engage in, unskillful speech, unskillful physical actions. So those are all the things that we want to be free of, the states of mind and the actions that come from them that cause us and the others to suffer. So then we began our discussion of joy this morning. That's on page 5. That starts, and I'll lead you in a meditation on this. And I realized in talking to Denise over lunch that I mentioned that there was a near enemy to joy, but I didn't talk about it this morning. Each of these immeasurables, as I explained previously, has a far enemy, and by that we mean the thing that's most opposed to it, that this thought is there as a direct antidote or remedy towards. And for joy, we could say that to some degree there might be two that we would say. One is when we're talking about the joy that we aren't cultivating in regard to ourselves, the kind of sense of despair or cynicism that we might have that can be really problematic on our path. You know, so this is, or even in our lives for that matter, might even lead to depression and what have you. But this is kind of on a personal level, what we would say is the far enemy, is when we're in that state of a bit of despair, or even being, like I said, sort of cynical, not being quite in touch with how good things actually are, or putting things down, thinking that, you know, it's not that worthwhile to take note of or to be rejoicing in. So then when we generate joy in regard to our own qualities and our own things that we have in our lives, then, of course, we can remove that despair, even remove that cynicism if we're quite attentive to it. So the other one that's the near enemy, and by near enemy we mean something that's really close to it that you could mistake for it, that you think might be in the same category as it. And we've discussed those for each of the immeasurables. For immeasurable joy, when we talk about others, when we talk about our joy in others, I'm sorry, I skipped over the far enemy for that. I'm still dealing with lunch mind or something, lunch brain. So when we go to what is the far enemy when we're talking about rejoicing in others, it's jealousy, because jealousy is what keeps us from being really delighted at others' good fortune. You know, we're envious of what they have. We don't want them to have what they have. We even, as I mentioned this morning, are delighted when they don't get what they want, when they have horrible things happen to them. Hopefully we don't do that too much, but, you know, because it's a really quite negative state of mind. But jealousy is what we're really targeting when we start rejoicing in others' good fortune. And it's the exact opposite of that state of mind. So now to go on to the near enemy. The near enemy for sympathetic joy or empathetic joy is usually described as frivolous joy. Frivolous joy. And this is how Thupten Jinpa in A Fearless Heart describes it. He just says, this is the joy which grasps at pleasant but meaningless experiences. So So that's all they say about it, and it's kind of interesting. They don't really say much more. And so I guess we're really just talking about when our joy becomes more mundane and more, not even, as I mentioned over lunch when we talked about it a little bit, when you're not even kind of being cognizant of what brought that joyous experience to you. You know, when we are rejoicing kind of in a genuine way, then we're thinking about all the causes of those happinesses that others are experiencing or that we are able to experience, that things are arising on the basis of the wholesome conditions that we ourselves have created or that others have created. So we're sort of embracing the idea of cause and effect as it leads to more favorable conditions, whether it be higher rebirth, you know, a good rebirth, or liberation, enlightenment. We can kind of have that understanding behind it. But if we get something, you know, we experience something delicious, delightful, and all we do is we just kind of generate this joy at, I get to partake of this, without thinking about kind of something more substantial behind it, probably we're only going to create more attachment by virtue of that joyous experience, because it's not going to be grounded in any kind of understanding. It's not going to be even grounded in the understanding of, okay, this is a joyous experience I'm having now. What do I need to do to create that again? How do I need to be attentive to always trying to create the causes and conditions for well-being for myself, and of course well-being for others as well? So there's not a lot written about this near enemy, but I think it's, again, just when our joy or delight starts to become a bit too mundane, a bit too frivolous, a bit too meaningless. It doesn't really have kind of any great import behind it. I don't know if others have any thoughts on that they want to share. I, by means, am not the only person that can teach in the room. Other people have their own understanding. So,
giddiness?
Well, giddiness might be a part of it. The word frivolous to me has more the connotation of meaningless, you know, like it doesn't really have any great import. Yes, would you like to share something? What's your name?
I'm Patty.
Hi, Patty. No.
It's expected. And so you have the appreciation or the thanks or the gratitude for something that you have.
I think that's very good, Patty. That may be another dimension of it too, is that people don't have kind of an appreciation for it at the moment, and consequently they don't have the gratitude. You know, they don't experience it fully in that capacity. So it's, yeah, I mean, again, frivolous, I don't know what the full definition of frivolous is. I'm by no means an expert. Not serious, yeah. Not meaningful, not purposeful. I don't know. Frivolity is usually just like meaningless. Giddiness might be one way to talk about it. That may be a bit more extreme. But just, it's not purposeful. Yeah. Yeah, Christine.
I was just thinking the same action could cause immeasurable joy the bright joy or the frivolous, like out there at the table could have been, yay, chocolate, and not thought past, but wow, how nice, this person thought to bring chocolate for us and gave it to us and is sharing us. So
yeah.
I'm thinking if you view things a different way, like I love concerts and I could be just like, yeah, music's awesome, or I could be like, these people write these meaningful songs and then go away from home and go around to share their gifts with us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can, some things you could, depending how deep you think about it.
Sure. No, I think that's a good part of it too, Christine, when we do recognize that it's again got its own causes and conditions, why that experience is coming into our lives. And not just have the joy that's delighting at that happening, but understanding that there's all that behind that, that all the various things that were behind the scenes that created that in your life. So that's another way that I think our joy again becomes more meaningful. Yeah,
so
that was good.
I Googled it, right? So
what is frivolity?
It's not having any serious purpose or value.
Yeah.
Synonyms are flippant, glib, facetious, joking, lighthearted, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So what you said, like meaningless, right? Not really having any...
Not having a real purpose.
Yeah.
So, again, And why, again, I think that becomes problematic is because it will tend to create more attachment. You know, when we're just in that space of not really thinking about what's going on, then we don't have the cognizance of all the causes and conditions that led to that. We don't have a recognition that we need to do something additionally to keep creating that. I mean, one of the main reasons, as I mentioned, when we talk about immeasurable joy, it's not purely rejoicing. Because it's also having this wish that others attain these levels of happiness and then rejoicing with them. So it's got a bit of loving kindness to it, but it's also that idea of taking joy in others' good fortune. But one of the reasons why we personally engage in rejoicing, especially in our own good deeds and actions and qualities, is because we want to create the energy behind that that causes us to keep doing what we're doing. You know, we are on a track where we haven't taken such great delight in virtue. We've probably taken more delight in non-virtue, frankly, you know, because every time we eat with attachment, every time we listen to music with attachment, every time we do anything with attachment, we're creating more non-virtue. We're just following a mind of attachment, a deluded state of mind. So that's what we take delight in, you know. Get home from work and you just pour a drink and turn on the music and whatever, you know, all the stuff that we kind of distract ourselves with. Well, we need to cause ourselves to take delight in virtue, to come home and, you know, read a Dharma book or do our meditation or whatever the case might be. You know, I'm not saying those are solely Dharma. Dharma is, as we know, a much deeper concept. We're going to look at that tomorrow night in the class. We look at the eight worldly concerns and what does it mean to really practice Dharma? You know, to let go of our attachment to this life and to be really concerned about creating these virtuous causes, engaging in more wholesome thoughts. So, I'm just pointing that out, that one of the reasons why we rejoice in ourselves and our own qualities is because we need that energy. That's why we call it joyous enthusiasm and joyous effort, because we have to combine those things. Joy becomes a really major component of putting effort into anything. They even say that one of the factors in creating that type of joyous enthusiasm is to have the joy that's like a child playing. You know, if you've seen young kids, my brother was amazing. He could, like, play by himself in the basement for hours and hours. And he would, like, create a whole baseball game and he'd throw a ball up against the wall. I mean, I could never be that entertained so easily by myself. But, you know, when you've seen children at play and they're just so delighted, they don't even pause. They just keep playing, keep playing, keep playing. You know, the older we get, I think the less we're enthralled by that type of thing, but we nonetheless have our own patterns we go to and we just, you know, don't necessarily apply this to virtue. And that's what we have to do, is to start seeing that we need to have that same kind of joyous engagement in what we're doing. As I said earlier, you know, the one teacher who told me, if you're practicing Buddhism and it's not fun, not joyous, you know, you're not doing it right. You know, it's not this heavy-duty thing that's like drudgery. Oh, I've got to do that. You know, it should be, oh, good, I get to do this. You see? So, sure, Anna.
Could you touch on divine pride? I keep wondering what that means.
Has
to do with joy, or that has nothing to do? What does that mean?
The concept that Anna's referring to that we call divine pride, pride itself, when we usually talk about it, is a delusion, because it's an inflated sense of self, a puffed up idea of who we are. And it can be, there's seven types of pride in Buddhism. I'm not going to go there, but, you know, pride can get really distorted, especially if we start thinking we're better than beings who are actually much better than ourselves. You know, if I like said, oh, Dalai Lama, he's nothing. You know, when you see how ridiculous it sounds, right? You know, if you had that level of pride, that would be pretty horrible. Pride, when we use it in this context of divine pride, we're actually talking about a sort of sense of very high self-esteem, where we're thinking of ourselves in the tantric teachings as actually having the manifestation at this moment of our Buddhahood. So we're using the practice that's called deity yoga in tantric Buddhism, where you're visualizing yourself in your future Buddha state. And you use particular models of Buddhism, archetypes of Buddhism. So some people might practice, for example, you've got green Tara, we got the 21 Taras. You might use green Tara over there, Thousand-armed Chen Rezig, who embodies compassion. You have all these different archetypes, and you become initiated into, willingly, this isn't something that happens to you without you knowing it, you make that decision in your Buddhist career to take a tantric empowerment, and then on the basis of that particular being, that Buddha figure that you've been indoctrinated and initiated into, you do a practice where you visualize yourself arising in the form of that, not just as pure imagination, because you do it in combination with other yogas, emptiness yoga and so on, and try to cultivate this wish that you could be a Buddha right now. Why? Because if I've got to wait to become a Buddha, however many great countless eons in the future, all these beings are suffering until then. All, you know, every being is continuing to suffer because I'm not enlightened yet. Therefore, I've got to become enlightened now. Therefore, I want to think of myself as a Buddha now. Therefore, I need the divine pride that thinks I am in this state right now. Nothing to do with pride. And if it gets tainted by ordinary pride, mundane pride, afflicted pride, then it's not a helpful mind to create. It's holding the awareness that, again, we have Buddha nature. We have the potential to manifest in this form. We're going to think of ourselves being that right now and try to enact the welfare of others from that place. And through various yogas, other practices, we can eventually become a Buddha much more quickly, because Tantra has some very powerful techniques that are used in conjunction with deity yoga.
That's
a yogi. Yeah, yogis and yoginis, yeah. Dakas and Dakini, the yogas and Dakini, Dakas and Dakini. There's a song in there somewhere, Denise. Okay. Any other questions on this, what we've been talking about in terms of these near enemies, far enemies? Yeah, Lee needs the microphone there. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you. This is kind of related to Anna's question. I was thinking about the near enemy, the despair regarding ourselves and the low self-esteem and the way, you know, in our culture we mm-hmm. or we come from this idea that we're innately flawed. And mm-hmm. I think I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about Buddha nature, as sort of like maybe thinking about Buddha nature as an antidote to that
sure.
way of thinking.
And sure. See, I touched on this a little bit this morning, but, you know, if we... Buddha nature is kind of a difficult concept in some ways, because I want to give a little more of a technical answer first, and then we'll relate it back into a more experiential thing of looking at it. We can say that there's two components to our Buddha nature, what they call it, Tathagata Garbha, the Tathagata essence. This essentially is kind of in line with what we could say is our conventional reality and our ultimate reality. You know, kind of how things are on the surface and appearance and how they are at their deepest level of existence. And they're related to our minds. So Buddha nature is always tied up with the concept of mind or consciousness. And so in terms of its conventional nature, our minds have the ability to develop into the state of Buddhahood. I mean, this is why we're all signed up for this path, is because we're not fixed in our crazy, deluded, wacky minds right now. We know we can develop our minds to be like the Dalai Lama, to be like these great beings, to be Chen Rezig, to be Tara, to be all of these enlightened beings. This is the developmental Buddha nature. It's really referring to the fact that the mind is not fixed in its own way in terms of it is totally changeable. Our minds are always changing. We just don't have much control over that process, because we keep following and recreating the habitual patterns that we bought into lifetime after lifetime. But we can become the agent of change, recognize our Buddha nature and our Buddha potential, and develop our minds towards Buddhahood. So that's the more impermanent side of it, the changing part of it, that recognizes that we're not fixed where we are and we are able to develop our minds fully. That developmental Buddha nature is accompanied by the more ultimate truth of our Buddha nature or our minds, and that is that our minds are empty of inherent existence, which means that our minds, once more, are not fixed in terms of any inherent nature. Our minds are dependent arisings and are therefore empty of any kind of inherent nature, what we would call, in essence, the emptiness of the mind, not the emptiness like when you're feeling you know, nothing in my mind. The emptiness of my mind, meaning that my mind does not independently exist. My mind is a dependent arising. My mind is therefore, because these two work together, the ultimate nature and the conventional nature, therefore my mind can develop. The only way that things could change is if they lacked inherent nature. If they had an inherent nature, they never could change. Nonetheless, that emptiness is a constant throughout the entire duration of the mind, which is forever. Our minds have no beginning. Our minds have no end. There's always the emptiness of the mind, the fact that the mind does not exist intrinsically, inherently. And this is, of course, the deeper teaching. Remember the two wings. We've been mostly working with the compassion wing. This is the wisdom wing. This is the one that actually says, and how it actually is, if we investigate deeper, is that any phenomenon, whether it be our mind, whether it be a table, whether it be a, I don't know why a bear came to mind, a tree. I didn't see a bear out there or anything. I don't know why, where a bear came from. Any phenomenon you can establish has an emptiness. It doesn't exist intrinsically, inherently. It's a dependent arising. It arises in dependence upon other factors. Okay? So again, I don't want to spend a whole afternoon talking about emptiness, so maybe people in the audience might want me to. But when we go back to the idea of Buddha nature, what we're talking about then is these two things that are two sort of characteristics, if you will, of the mind. Its conventional nature, which is the fact that it is changeable, that it is can be developed all the way to Buddhahood, and its empty nature, which is the fact that it lacks any intrinsic or set or permanent existence, and therefore it can be developed. It's sort of like that is the reason why it can be developed, is because of its emptiness. As Nagarjuna says, you know, because of emptiness, everything is possible. For him who emptiness is not possible, nothing is possible. For him whom emptiness is possible, everything is possible. So the teachings are never contradictory. Emptiness of the mind and the mind in its conventional nature are always existing in tandem, completely complementary. So that's the technical part of what we mean by Buddha nature, is the fact that our minds are empty of inherent existence. Therefore, you know, they can be changed. Therefore, we can develop them to that state. So when we reflect on that as an antidote to this kind of despair or even the kind of overwhelm that we might feel in looking at others, which is what we talked about a bit. Laura brought up that question yesterday. I mentioned that this morning, that when we have that despair, when we're thinking about the suffering of all beings, and we might feel like it's kind of a hopeless situation. Well, it isn't hopeless because we have Buddha nature. And this is something we can rejoice in for ourselves. It's not like we created it. It's there. It's just a natural fact that our minds are empty of inherent existence and that they can be developed. But we can rejoice that we have that potential, you know, and that we also are making progress in that direction, that the steps that we're taking are helping that Buddha potential to develop, helping our Buddha nature to be revealed in a sense. In the text that they study in the master, in the basic program, the Uttara Tantra, there's all these wonderful analogies for Buddha nature that are very inspiring. Buddha Maitreya, who wrote that text, there's nine, even called, they call them similes. So Buddha nature is said to be like the pauper, the poor person who is in a house where right underneath the floorboards is amazing wealth. You know, like all this gold, but never knows that the wealth is there. So it's like you're rich, but you don't know it. And that's one way to think about it in terms of you now know it. You all know it, that you have Buddha nature. You're rich beyond belief because you have this incredible resource that is your Buddha nature, your Buddha potential that you can develop into that state. Whereas most beings go around all dejected and thinking that they're nothing and, you know, they're going to die and it'll be all over and da-da-da-da. I mean, they don't realize kind of the huge potential, the huge capacity that they have to develop themselves to that degree. So it's like thinking of yourselves in that way, of having this incredible richness, then there's nothing to despair about. You know, there's nothing to get dejected about, nothing to be cynical about. You can, you know, be joyous that you have that and are aware of it. Were you going to say something, Laura Lee?
Thank you. I'm just wondering if the Buddha nature is not only includes that potential or the ability to change, but it's an inclination for goodness. It's like our, is our
right.
basic nature innately good.
Good
and already
yeah.
loving and kind, and is that
right.
part of the Buddha nature?
Well, in the Uttara Tantra, the text I mentioned, and in the study of that, it's kind of a twofold answer. We can say that we can't say that that's already all there, because otherwise it would be all manifest, right? I mean, if the loving kindness and compassion are already developed to an immeasurable degree, why would we even do this weekend, right? You know, if that's already there in terms of our Buddha nature, well then none of the development part of it would make sense. In other words, we do need to actively cultivate these more positive states of mind. We do need to put attention into generating them. But nonetheless, we can say that at that level of our Buddha nature, all of those qualities, I like to use the word, this isn't in the text, and this is my own kind of word for it, so keep that in mind, you know, that you, if you ever quote me on this, you're quoting me, you're not quoting, like, you know, Maitreya Buddha or something. I like to use the word that all these qualities, like immeasurable kindness and compassion and so on, that these are resonant with that mind, with that Buddha nature, meaning that they're completely in accord with it. They're fully supported by it. Now, I know when Venerable Rabina teaches, she says, at our deepest level, we are that goodness, we are that. And then we could say that in the context of that, those being resonant with that state of mind, with that purified mind. That is what we're talking about, a mind that is fundamentally pure. All of these things can be removed, all of the qualities developed, and we can become a Buddha. So within that pure mind, we could say they're there, they're resonant with it, as opposed to resident with it, which is kind of like meaning they're already there. And so I have a hard time with the idea that they're sort of already there because of what I just explained. That would mean that we already have those in a sense. Nonetheless, I mean, some teachers will talk about the Buddhist path of one of not being creating something you don't have, but rather revealing something that's already there. And sometimes that's a helpful way to think about it, but I don't. All the teachers that I've had, well, most of the teachers that I've had, really say that, again, we do have to roll up our sleeves and do the work to generate these qualities. But they are completely supported by what we mean as our underlying Buddha nature. Whereas all the negative qualities, the negative tendencies, our jealousy, our greed, our anger, none of them are supported by our Buddha nature. They're sort of, again, what stains and, you know, kind of pollutes our Buddha, our minds, but they are not supported by our Buddha nature. Why? Because they're not grounded in truth. They're all delusions. That's why that word delusion is a very powerful one, because it speaks to the fact that they can be uprooted, because they're not resonant with truth. They're not resonant with our fundamental nature. They're in opposition to it. Along those lines, the one quote that I frequently use is from Suzuki Roshi, who said to a group of students once, he said, "You're all perfect just as you are, and you could use a little work." And it's kind of holding that kind of idea that, you know, at our deepest level, we could say there is this perfection, this perfect state of mind, this perfect clarity, this perfect purity, this perfect emptiness.
Let it shine.
And yet we need the work to make it shine, to let that be kind of manifest. So again, however we want to look at our path, is it one of, you know, creating something that isn't there or revealing something that's already there? I think we have to do the work nonetheless. We have to roll up our sleeves and put our energy into this. Recalling our Buddha nature helps us to really have the understanding of why that's all possible. Because everything that is contrary to that can be removed. It's not in the nature of your mind to be angry. If it was, you would be angry all the time. Now you might think, well, but it's not in the nature of my mind to be compassionate, because I'm not compassionate all the time. You know, might come back at me with that. And I can say, well, at that level, sure, because we can say that you don't have compassion to that degree. But compassion can be supported in the face of ultimate reality. The fact that every being doesn't, you know, exist inherently or intrinsically, I can still have compassion for them in the face of that. In fact, my compassion becomes even stronger in the face of that, because I recognize that everyone is adhering to a sense of self that is totally fiction. And if they could only know that simple truth, they would be free of all their suffering. So if my compassion can be completely complemented by the truth of emptiness, by my Buddha nature, whereas my anger can't be. My anger doesn't hold up in the face of that. Does this make sense, kind of the way I'm explaining it? Yeah, Anna. 1 second, we'll wait for the microphone and then...
Could you just, if you don't mind, touch on arhats or bodhisattvas? I mean, is it such a difficult journey that, for instance, even arhats, from my understanding, mm-hmm. still have the subtlest obscurations? It's like, uh-huh. how much work is there? Or is it, it just depends on the individual person?
Right.
Arhats are in nirvana, aren't they? Or even...
Sure.
Even bodhisattvas, different levels, those bhumi levels, it's like, holy cow, how much work do we need to do to get there?
I understand.
Thank you.
But why don't we hold on to your question when we finish up joy, I want to go into the bodhisattva kind of path and bodhicitta and talk a little bit about the four immeasurables, how they fit into that, and I'll try to answer your question as part of that. But it's a very... I can give you the simple answer, but let's hold on and see if we have any more questions on the four immeasurables, and then we'll move into that.
Yeah. I need to ask this question before we get into immeasurable joy, because it's going to mm-hmm. be dogging me throughout the whole thing. Because it's going to be dogging me throughout the whole thing, so I need to ask this question about mm-hmm. about joy. I had a discussion with a Christian friend. Some time back, and I was talking about happiness, and he was equating happiness and joy as if they're synonymous. Mm-hmm. And so, is that true? Is it the same? It seems to me there's a difference. It may be a subtle difference, or maybe I'm not sure. But it seems to me there's a difference between happiness and joy.
I think the way we're talking about it, yes, there is a difference, but it's hard to articulate the difference. Mm-hmm. You know. When we get into the joy that we're trying to cultivate as part of immeasurable joy, there is a feeling of happiness to it. We can't deny that it's falling on that side of the scale. It's not, you know, like you're sad or miserable because you're cultivating joy. So happiness, I guess the way I might delineate some of this is that we could say that happiness is more of a feeling, if you will, feeling tone, whereas joy has a bit more of a thought process behind it, if you will. But I don't want to make it sound too intellectual, because I think we are still talking about a heart quality. Yeah. Otherwise, again, you know, it's part of the kind heart. It's not... But in Buddhism, recall that, I mean, heart and mind are not isolated so
That's
much.
Right,
They're part of the whole landscape of consciousness. So the joy that we're talking about creating here, I think, is, again, this real uplifting, like we use the word delight, but just a real sense of I don't know, transcendence that we have around looking at the things we have and that others have, and generating this sharing with, this empathetic kind of quality. Whereas happiness can have a lot of different degrees to it, but it's usually all tied up with receiving a pleasant feeling on the basis of something. Mm-hmm. We can have more temporal happiness and mundane happiness, but we can also have more transcendent forms of happiness too. Mm-hmm. But I think joy, I don't know, this is just me pontificating about it perhaps and not really understanding all the ways of delineating these things.
Yeah.
Now, when we get to something like His Holiness's book that I mentioned earlier that he did with Archbishop Desmond Tutu called The Book of Joy, and Douglas Abrams kind of helped them put this together, but in that context, they talk about joy really being this kind of deep spiritual joy, kind of a radiant contentment that beings like His Holiness and the Archbishop exude. They just come from that place of a very joyful heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that has some kinship to happiness too, but seems to transcend it in some ways as well. But in this context, I think we are talking about that feeling of delight that can arise on the basis of rejoicing in our own good fortune and others' good fortune.
Let me add, my answer.
What was your answer?
Yeah, this is years ago, so I could have been totally off base. But my answer was I thought the difference to me at that time Now you're talking, I'm wondering. But the difference to me at that time was that happiness is something that we're trying to realize, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so and the whole idea of happiness is equated with contentment and being mm-hmm. being satisfied, being at peace, and so that's where we want mm-hmm. to be. And to me, that's lasting, that's eternal if we can ever get there.
Right.
Joy seems more temporal to me. Seems more temporary. It can go up and down. It depends upon what's happening to us at that particular time. It can be joyful at this, so I'm not sure. But the way you're saying it, it might be pretty much the same thing, because
I don't know. I mean, it sounded like it was a little bit the other way around the way I said it. But you know, I don't want to get too much into semantics, because I think with the English language in particular, we have so many different words. I mean, what is bliss compared to joy, or what is, you know, and I'm, you know, I don't want to get too caught up in it, rather than to understand, okay, when we talk about joy in this context, we're mostly talking about this joyful partaking of and participating with the joy that others have, the experience of happiness that others have, the delight that others have, and sharing in that. And then also with regard to ourselves. You know, so I don't know. I don't want to dodge your question necessarily.
We've talked
about it a bit, but I don't know that I have absolute clarity on when it comes to these words in English. And we're somewhat limited. English is a wonderful language, but I've found in like Tibetan studies that there might be a Tibetan word that three or four different English words could describe it, but they all have different flavors to it, whereas the Tibetan word actually has so much more richer
meaning. And I try to apply the KISS method, keep it simple, sweetheart.
So let's do a short meditation. If, you know, rather than talk more about rejoicing and joy, let's do a short meditation. But please, stand up before we do this, because we've been sitting for about 45 minutes, and we need to kind of get things circulating, or else what's going to happen is we're going to go right into sleep when we close our eyes to meditate. So do a little stretch, whatever you need to do, and we'll do a short meditation. And I will get to Anna's question at some point. I'll do my best.
I looked up through the night and said, oh, you feel really funny.
Uh-huh.
I find it very amusing.
They can be. They're very inspiring, though, too.
I know.
Which one did you find funny?
They're all funny. Emperor and an ugly hag spoon. But I like an icon covered with slime.
Yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually they use, instead of icon, they'll say like a Buddha statue that's like covered in mud and dirt and everything.
Oh, they have a Buddha inside a muddy lotus. They have that one.
Yeah.
They have a bee grain inside. It's tough. It goes in a sewer. Buddha nature. No.
Yeah.
Under the earth, germ within a seed, statue wrapped in filthy rags, and the emperor and the hags will icon covered slime. So.
Okay. Okay. So we're going to make this meditation perhaps a little bit briefer than some of them that we've done, because we're running out of time. We've got about an hour and 15 minutes for the afternoon, so hopefully enough time to touch on some issues. But it is important that we sort of taste these meditations ourselves. So you don't need to have anything open in front of you except either the page that has the Immeasurable Joy Prayer, which would be page 6 of that packet, or you can have the sheet in front of you that has all four immeasurables on it. It's the same wording in each of these. So either one of them is fine to have in front of you, and we'll recite that together when we get to the Immeasurable Joy. So let's just take a moment to do just a couple of minutes of meditation on the breath. Focus the mind a bit. So now we're going to begin with cultivating joy in our own goodness. And we'll go on to looking at least at one other being. And then we'll make this immeasurable in the third step. So beginning with yourself, first of all, just to have that cognizance that you're the same as all beings and deserving to be happy, both temporally and ultimately. And also how you possess the potential to experience those states of well-being. And just be very, kind of okay with that idea. Sometimes, again, we are very hard on ourselves, somehow think that we aren't capable or deserving of happiness. But we are, absolutely. And I want you to begin to think about some of the things that you can be joyful for, you can rejoice in. Begin with thinking about your own good actions and qualities, the things that you do, even the slightest things that have been beneficial to others or to you, yourself, or to both yourself and others. So we don't need to go far to find these, but examples might be the way that you do engage in a spiritual practice that's both for your own benefit as well as for others, the time you spend studying, practicing, meditating, coming to the center, engaging in teachings. Just rejoice and feel very good about these. Think about the kindness you show to others through your generosity, the morality you practice in relation to others, not harming them through your actions, through your speech, through your thoughts. Spend a minute or so rejoicing in all of these amazing good qualities and good actions, and feel it's good that you've done these, that you have these, and encourage yourself to continue to do these. As I mentioned, that's a key part of rejoicing in yourself. And as you do this, generate a more and more expansive feeling of joy in your heart. And we're not just thinking about these things that we've done or qualities we possess. We're generating joy on the basis of that, feeling this warmth, this delight in our hearts. It might be somewhat akin to the feeling that we have when our team wins or something like that, but not distorted in that way, not biased, but rather the joy that arises when we recognize what is good in our lives, what we can be pleased about. Even extend this out to all the good things that you have in your life. The fact that you have a job or a family, a house, food on the table, money in the bank, a car, whatever possessions, things that you have in your life, all these resources, all the good things that you have access to, especially even in the Dharma, the fact that you have a center here, you have a place to come to be with like-minded people, to engage in Buddhist practice. All of these things you have in your life were created through the force of your own good actions in the past. They are the results of that. By rejoicing in them, we're rejoicing in the causes of them, all our own good qualities and actions that produce them. So generate joy in all of this that you have in your life and feel great delight in your heart. And then generate the wish for you yourself to experience all happiness, both temporal and ultimate, within the context of understanding that we need more temporal experiences of happiness, goodness in our lives in order to be a platform, a foundation for our practice, and then we can eventually achieve those more ultimate states, liberation, enlightenment, and sincerely want this for yourself. And generate joy in the thought of being in that state, of having temporal happiness, having ultimate happiness. And you can even articulate that wish towards yourself, with thoughts such as, may I never be parted from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation, both temporal and ultimate happiness. May my own good fortune never diminish or depart. Again, hold that within the space of joy. Then we'll work with one individual from the three groups, and as usual, work with a friend. It's easiest to start there, perhaps even the person that you feel the closest to in this life, or the being, might be again a pet or a family member, friend, what have you, whoever it is that comes to mind, and visualize them in the space before you. And recall that this person too has good qualities and actions, just like yourself, in the way that you've rejoiced in your own good fortune, your own good actions, the results of that, the things that you have in your life and so on. We can do the same for this person and begin to generate joy in your heart, thinking at all the amazing qualities of this being before you, all the ways that they are kind and attentive, caring. They may not even be on the same spiritual path as you, but you can still rejoice in all the good qualities they possess. And especially rejoice in the actions of this friend, this dear one, the good things that this being does that will lead to future happiness, both temporal happiness and ultimate happiness. All the ways that they engage in beneficial and virtuous activity. And really wish and want this being in front of you to know that, to experience all temporal and ultimate happiness. And with this sympathetic joy, this feeling with their own being in a state of well-being, cultivate these thoughts towards them, such as, may you never be parted from the happiness of higher rebirth, liberation, enlightenment. May your own good fortune never diminish or depart. May you know all measure of happiness. Whatever thoughts work for you towards this being, within the space of joy, genuinely want that for them. And we're going to extend this thought out to all beings in this concluding part where we cultivate this immeasurable joy, having the same empathetic or sympathetic joy for all beings. So visualize them surrounding you, the three groups of friends, dear ones, difficult people or enemies, and then the countless strangers. And recall some of the previous thoughts we've had about how incredibly kind all of these beings are. How every one of these beings has both positive and negative qualities. Every one of these beings wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. Every one of these beings has the potential to achieve both temporal and ultimate happiness. And we can rejoice in all the good fortune that any of these beings have. But moreover, make that strong wish, that thought that wants them to have both temporal and ultimate happiness. And we start with the first line of the immeasurable joy prayer. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never separated from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation. Just hold that kind of immeasurable aspiration. And in the space of this, cultivate joy. Imagining all beings in a state of having a good rebirth, all the good conditions within that, always having that, attaining liberation, enlightenment, never be separated from that. And then the immeasurable prayer or wish that wants this to come to pass for all of these beings. Let's recite that line. May they never be separated from these. And feel the strength of that, that it's not just this nice idea that we can aspire towards, but we want this to actually be so. And here too, try to do that within the space of this joyous mind, thinking about all beings at those places of both temporal and ultimate happiness. Always having that, never separated from that. May that be so. And then that level of immeasurable resolve or extraordinary thought, where we recognize that we want to do this for others, that we need to take this burden upon ourselves. Once more, recalling their incredible kindness, recalling that every one of these beings has benefited you in so many ways. And then try on that thought of thinking that you'll take responsibility for that by reciting the third line. I myself will cause them to never be separated from these. And see if there's some joy in your heart within that thought. It might feel quite challenging to take on that task of bringing all sentient beings to both temporal and ultimate happiness. Let's see if you can light that spark of joy, that delight within your heart, seeing that this is also how you achieve your greatest welfare, by being fully dedicated to the welfare of others. How wonderful. And then seeing that we need not do this completely on our own, we have the enlightened beings and our gurus to help us on this path. And so we visualize our own gurus manifesting in the form of forearm Chenrezig above the crown of our heads, on a lotus and moon disc, seated in the Vajra posture with four arms, the first right and left arm holding a wish-fulfilling jewel at his heart. The second left hand holding an open lotus. And the second right hand holding a crystal rosary, crystal mala. These four arms representing all four immeasurables that are embodied in this Buddha of compassion. And feeling the amazing qualities of this being, know that without a doubt these holy beings will help us, to achieve this state of unparalleled joy and bliss, delighting in the welfare of others, helping them to never be parted from these exalted states of liberation and enlightenment, never to be parted from good rebirths, and generate this wish to receive the blessings by reciting the fourth line, after which you can feel the nectar and light descending down from Guru Chenrezig, filling your whole being, removing all the obstacles, and enhancing all of your positive qualities. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do so. And feel the blessings of the Guru open up to that enlightening energy that we need on our path to accomplish this and all the immeasurables. And then make a strong dedication from this practice that you will be able to cultivate the measurable joy as well as equanimity, love, compassion, and funnel these into bodhicitta through your bodhicitta, engage in the practices of the bodhisattva, accomplish all the paths and grounds, and become enlightened quickly for the sake of all beings. and lead them to enlightenment as well. Okay. So any comments about the meditation or about joy? Yes, Lori. Microphone, yeah.
Yes, I was wondering, I have a hard time discerning between gratitude and joy.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for me to feel gratitude or identify with the gratitude than mm-hmm. the joy. Are they similar? Or?
I would say that they're definitely similar. Gratitude is kind of the preliminary thought to some degree that accompanies this joy, because especially when we look at, okay, so if we're focusing on ourselves and being grateful for the things we have in our lives, the qualities we've been able to cultivate, all the actions we engage in, then that can spark that joy. But I don't know that they're equivalent, because then I would say, yeah, they're very much, you know, again, when we go back to His Holiness and the Archbishop's book, that's one of what are called the eight pillars of joy, is gratitude, because we see that gratitude definitely does give rise to a very joyful feeling. So I don't know. I again, these kind of questions around those sorts of things, they have some kinship, but I don't know that they're identical by any means. But I think gratitude can definitely increase our joy. I remember in that film, what was it called, The Secret? Some of you have seen The Secret, right? You know, and it's got some nice ideas in it. It's not like completely in line with what Buddhism says, but there was one gentleman who talked about how he kept a gratitude stone around his neck or in his pocket or something, because it reminded him to feel grateful for all the things he had. I would say if we accompanied that gratitude stone or some way of recalling gratitude for things with the joy that arises on the basis of having those, it could be a very powerful practice. Because we can see that it does open up, gratitude does open up to experiencing that. But gratitude alone may not trigger as much joy unless we really accompany it with that thought. Might be just been, again, a bit more fleeting and temporary, whereas joy, we're trying to develop a more long-lasting, deeper sense of joy. But, yeah, I think they can go in tandem. What were your thoughts on it? Do you have any thoughts, Lori?
I don't know. I've had this question off and on. And I can think of the things that I have and that the people that I care about have and be very happy for them that mm-hmm. they have these, and think back to that they've created these causes and conditions to have these things. Mm-hmm. And that's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Maybe my understanding of what joy is isn't fully there, because... Mm-hmm.
I don't know that any of ours are. I mean, what's interesting in the Book of Joy, His Holiness and the Archbishop call joy a byproduct more than an actual thing. Like if you sit down and say, I'm going to be joyous, you're kind of missing the boat, you know. If you say, I'm going to do all these things that induce joy, and that's why gratitude is on the list of these eight pillars of joy. The other ones, by the way, are perspective, humility, humor, acceptance. Those are what they call the four of the mind. And then there's four of the heart, which are forgiveness, compassion, generosity, and gratitude. You know, and so we can see how all of those are like, they're circling around joy. They're not all identical to joy, but they all induce generally quite joyous feelings. But then I think we have to accompany that, as I said, with kind of a bit more thoughts and things that help us to deepen that joy. Not just stop at, oh, how wonderful that this is happening in this moment, but think about, yeah, everything that leads to that and how we want to make sure that we continue to do that and we encourage others to continue to do that, because we are in control. Again, this is all still framed within the context of karma, that everything we have arises from causes and conditions. It's not independently arising. So we're in the driver's seat. So... Yeah. Good. It's a good question.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, Denise over here, Christine, or Donna.
Hi. have a question about the visualization, the forearm chenrezig.
Uh-huh.
Do we have an image of that here we can look at? Oh, okay. I'm wondering, I thought you said that each arm you could think to represent one of the immeasurables.
Right. And which one represents which? Is that your question?
Is there an association of one with the other? Because I was just thinking that maybe the item that he's holding might give me a clue to help understand each one a little bit more.
I've heard them just referred to as representing the four immeasurables, but never the specific one. In terms of what that Buddha of compassion is holding, I do have a little,
Thank you.
I do have a little description from, I think this is from John Landau's book, The Images of Enlightenment, that he did with Andy Weber. And he says here, his first two hands are pressed together at his heart, supplicating all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to look after sentient beings and protect them from suffering. These hands hold a wish-fulfilling jewel, symbolic of Chenrezig's compassionate bodhicitta motivation, the aspiration to become fully enlightened for the sake of all beings. His other right hand holds a crystal rosary, symbolizing his ability to liberate beings from samsara with skillful means, and reminding the practitioner to recite his six-syllable mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. In his left hand, he holds the stem of a blue Utpala flower. Utpala is another name for a lotus flower, symbolizing his stainless and compassionate bodhicitta motivation. So bodhicitta is kind of in there all over. You've got bodhicitta motivation, and you've got kind of the ability to liberate sentient beings from samsara. You've got bodhicitta in the jewel in the middle, so I don't know that you could correlate.
It's not
an
obvious.
Four hands,
yeah.
But,
okay, thank you.
But I have heard that in general they refer to the four immeasurables kind of incorporated into that being, that Buddha of compassion. Any other questions or comments on... Yeah.
I just want to add to it, to be joyful, that how fortunate we are to know, to have had, you know, the accessibility to the Dharma and the karma, to practice the Dharma, and how many people, you know, I don't like to say it, but rebuff it or don't even know about it, don't have a clue. I mean, that in itself should bring us to enlightenment. I mean, wow.
I mean, that's
what an unveiling. Huh?
Well, absolutely. And that's part of that kind of contemplation on our good fortune and our current state, is because look at how many human beings are on this planet. How many of them have taken an interest in these teachings and have some conviction in them, some faith in them, and want to practice them? It's very limited. And again, we don't want to get into judgmental stuff. That's not why we talk about this, like, oh, lucky us.
No, but I'm just saying how fortunate we
are. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, while we have it, make sure we use it well. You know, we don't know when this is all going to end. That's teaching right after precious human rebirth, right? Impermanence and death. In a second, it can be over. So if there's no more questions or comments on those, I feel like we've kind of done the four immeasurables. Hopefully you have some confidence now in being able to recite that prayer and work with each of these thoughts. These notes I put together are by no means absolute and complete. Feel free to enhance them with other teachings you've had or with other understandings that you've had. But know that this is a process of working with this, and it's nice to do both levels. You know, I talked about how it's important to work with individuals. So you can certainly start there, and you can say, okay, I'm going to really try to cultivate these four immeasurables with regard to my fill-in-your-blank, whoever this person is that you want to just try to generate more love, compassion, caring, concern, and then see if you can enhance it and develop it. Of course, equanimity is where we're looking at a wider scale of beings, but even with regard to that one person, we've got some sort of a distorted view with them probably. That person who's very close to us, we no doubt have some attachment. That person who's very, you know, a stranger to us, we have some indifference. That person who's an enemy to us, we have some animosity or aversion. So it's important for us to, again, engage in these on an individual basis as much as possible, to try to develop more equanimity towards each individual, more love, more compassion, more joy. But then occasionally to go to that level of all sentient beings, because even though that's quite nebulous at some level, it's useful to open our hearts to that degree, to challenge ourselves, to see what is it like to have a heart that's as open as all of existence, not just this world, but even beyond this world. So the four immeasurables in bodhicitta, on page 6 of your handout, there's a few quotes that I put there. And there's a quote that's attributed to Nyanagarbha. Nyanagarbha was quoted in this context by Longchenpa, who was this great Tibetan practitioner. And this is all cited in a teaching by Anne Klein, so it's like three levels of quotes. So Anne Klein did a series for Tricycle Magazine on the Four Immeasurables, and she mentioned this verse. And I've seen it in another text too, but that was where I took it from in that wording. And it essentially says, on the well-prepared ground of equanimity, the flowers of love are scattered. They are furthered to fruition by the shade of compassion and purified by the clear waters of joy. A very poetic way of looking at how these four work together. Once more, don't see them as individual thoughts, but that the more you work on one, it enhances the others as well. And so they all kind of combine together to produce this unbelievable, you know, blossoming into Buddhahood. The next quote is from Alan Wallace, who many of you, you know, have heard of. Has he come here to teach, Alan? No, I don't think we've had him in Santa Fe either. He wrote a book called Genuine Happiness, and he has some teachings in there on the four measurables, but he combines them with, I think, Dzogchen's at the end, because he's big on Dzogchen, which is in the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, and he precedes it with a bunch of teachings on calm abiding, meditation. And actually, the one time I did a retreat on these, maybe I've done it twice, but I think when I do a retreat on these, I try to alternate calm abiding meditation with meditation on the four immeasurables. It's actually really quite nice. We did a little bit of it here by meditating on the breath for a few minutes, but I would do longer periods because it is useful to kind of develop calm abiding and then to focus on a particular object or at least some measure of calm abiding. None of us, well, I shouldn't speak for all of you. I don't have calm abiding at a fully qualified way. But so anyway, in his text he says, following the development of the four immeasurables and just before the cultivation of wisdom comes the crown jewel of all of Mahayana Buddhism. In Sanskrit it is called bodhicitta, which I translate as the spirit of awakening. Other people might translate it as the mind of enlightenment or the awakening mind. Bodhicitta is the heartfelt aspiration to achieve spiritual awakening for the sake of all beings, an aspiration fusing the two noblest goals. So we see that there are two aspirations in bodhicitta. Mostly what we've been working with in the four immeasurables is the idea that we want to be dedicated to the welfare of all beings, to do all of our work for the sake of all beings, to have that focus that their welfare is primary, is really important for us to embrace. Bodhicitta is the answer to how do we do that? And that combines that aspiration to be a benefit to others with the aspiration to become a Buddha. Recognizing that just as the analogy I used yesterday of the young girl who has people in her family who have cancer and she becomes very moved to become an oncologist and be able to treat people with cancer, or maybe she decides to become a researcher to be able to research into cures for cancer, whatever. She makes a decision that she wants to benefit people with cancer. That's like us making the decision we want to benefit all beings. But then she recognizes that in her current state, lacking education, lacking experience, lacking all the ability, she can't treat people with cancer. She can't do research that will help them. She needs to become qualified to do that. So it's the same for us. We need to become qualified to help all sentient beings to that degree. So we have two aspirations, and as Rinpoche says, we can always say that the main aspiration is to benefit others. That's really where the juice is, in a sense. You know, just like the person who, the young girl who wants to become the doctor or whatever, what's going to keep her going through all that education and all of that practice and internship and everything to be able to treat other people with cancer is her strong motivation to be a benefit to them. Hopefully. Hopefully she's not motivated by the paycheck that comes with being a doctor or something. Nowadays everything gets so skewed, and try to keep my analogies on a pure side, but anyway. So then it says, but pursuing this aspiration for oneself alone ignores something fundamental about the nature of our existence. None of us lives in isolation, independent of those around us. Our existence is one of interrelationship. Thus, our aspirations must include the welfare of others. So this brings us to our second noble aspiration. What can I do to help? So this is kind of, again, informing that the mind of saying, I'm going to become a Buddha, I'm going to, you know, develop that level of capability, has to always be accompanied by that, he calls it the second thought. Again, Rinpoche calls it the first thought. The first thought is, I want to benefit all beings. The second thought is, therefore, I need to become a Buddha. So, again, being dedicated to the welfare of others is the most important of these two thoughts, but we have to recognize that we absolutely have to become enlightened to do this. We just simply aren't capable in our current position to benefit beings to this degree. So most of you know these. I'm not going to spend tons of time going through these, but I do want to answer any questions and do get to Anna's question about arhats and their situation and bodhisattvas and all that. Let me actually do that as kind of a preliminary to this. When we define somebody as a bodhisattva, bodhisattva has that same root as bodhicitta, right? Bodhi is the same root as awakening, or as a Buddha, which means awakened. We could say bodhi means awakening. When we define somebody as a bodhisattva, we mean that they have bodhicitta deeply in their heart. In technical terms, what we would say is they have to have a sort of spontaneous or uncontrived bodhicitta. Right now, for all of us, we're going to go through the techniques of developing bodhicitta in a brief way. But for all of us, we have to sit down and actually think about this to get this mind to arise. It doesn't naturally arise. Again, I'm making assumptions. Sorry if some of you in the room have spontaneous bodhicitta. I'm not talking about you then. But for most of us, we have to sit down and go through some process of coming up with that mind, because it doesn't naturally arise. We're not trained in that. We're trained mostly in our self-centeredness, mostly in thinking about me, myself, and I every moment of the day. So we have to do training to cultivate that mind. When you have somebody who's developed that mind to that degree where it arises spontaneously, which is dependent upon a fairly deep level of meditation, this is why we need to do our meditation practice, our concentration, our stabilizing the mind, is because we won't have bodhicitta at that level unless we make the mind very focused, undistracted. That's why the teachings that are taught in the Lam Rim and the stages of the path to attain calm abiding are really important, because in the teachings that we had in Italy in the master's program, it said that to get uncontrived bodhicitta, in other words, to become a bodhisattva, you have to have calm abiding, or one of the stages just before calm abiding, like the eighth or ninth. One text said eighth, but the other one said ninth. The eighth or ninth stages are pretty subtle states of mind, very focused states of mind. Calm abiding. No, we're talking about the nine mental abidings that lead to calm abiding. Those of you who haven't studied this, I'm sorry for kind of throwing this out there, but calm abiding itself, it's called shamatha in the Sanskrit, or shine in the Tibetan. It is a state where, as is implied in the words calm abiding, where your mind is able to abide calmly with no distractions for as long as you wish on an object of meditation, and where in addition there is a sort of suppleness, a pliancy that you have of both body and mind that's manifest. You know, when I sit down to meditate, you know, I can meditate for a while and then the body starts getting a little difficult and the mind's not so good. And, you know, so there's a suppleness, a sort of serviceability that happens with the mind when you achieve that level. And you go through nine stages to get to that. And they're actually represented by, we don't have it in the room here, I think. Oh, it's out in the lobby. Okay. By the guy that's directing the elephant up the path. And there's nine different little pictures there, and then there's a tenth where you attain actual calm abiding, and an eleventh where you combine it with special insight. But anyway, the idea is that this is a process that's clearly delineated, and actually comes from the Hindu tradition, developing calm abiding. The Prince Siddhartha himself practiced with these great Hindu masters of meditation who taught him this methodology for taming the mind, calming the mind. So we need to develop that level of calm abiding in order to have this uncontrived bodhicitta, to have it that stable in our hearts. And that's kind of your golden ticket to being a bodhisattva. Once you have that uncontrived bodhicitta, you are technically a bodhisattva. You get your membership card and, you know, your discount. No, just kidding. The American Association of Bodhisattva People, the AABP. anyway, sorry for the jokes. So that's one path, certainly, and all of us who feel somewhat inclined to the Mahayana, it's best for us to enter the Mahayana path from the very beginning, train in the Lam Rim, the stages of the path, which all really kind of precede bodhicitta. The first level of the stages of the path where we become, you know, on the basis of having this human rebirth and having met the Dharma through our kind teachers, we recognize that this life will end, that we'll have a rebirth after this that could be unfortunate, therefore we take refuge, therefore we have conviction in karma, and we can actually determine our future rebirth. That's the first level. The second level is where we look at the bigger picture, the Four Noble Truths, and we come to understand that we can attain liberation from our suffering completely. So the first and the second stages of the path are about training ourselves in self-concern, self-compassion, and then the Mahayana, where we train in bodhicitta, and we eventually can develop that mind at that degree, and we can become a bodhisattva. So, if you have an inclination towards the Mahayana path, best to practice it from the beginning. If instead you enter the Hinayana path, which is another path that is completely valid that the Buddha taught, because not everybody has the predisposition to become a bodhisattva, to become a being that wants to become enlightened for the sake of all beings. Some beings can only bear the burden of their own liberation. And we call that the path of individual liberation or individual welfare, whereas the bodhisattva is more universal welfare, universal in its thought, thinking of all beings. So those who are inclined to that, certainly they enter into their own path, what we call the Hinayana path, the individual vehicle, and they do that on the basis not of bodhicitta, because they're not developing that mind, they do that on the basis of renunciation, which is a mind that is turning away from samsara and all of its suffering and the causes of suffering and turning towards liberation, towards nirvana. And they go through their own kind of path and practices to realize emptiness, to remove their own ignorance, to cause all their delusions, to have no support, to have all of their karma to be ineffective and attain nirvana. They attain a state where they have removed everything that afflicts the mind, everything that causes suffering. They've attained back in the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering at the most basic level by accomplishing nirvana, and they've become an arhat.
But only for themselves.
Well, they've done it out of their primary concern. Now, they practice in the Hinayana tradition, they practice the Four Immeasurables. They practice opening their hearts to the welfare of others because those qualities are also part of who they are, but they don't go to the extreme of cultivating bodhicitta, or let's say the next step of cultivating bodhicitta. And maybe they haven't even been introduced to that, or they simply just have a predisposition towards the Hinayana path. So there is some limitation, what we would call still some limitation in their view in terms of their self-concern, that they aren't able to break out of an individual perspective to a more universal perspective. Now, those beings who engage in that whole path and become an arhat, the traditional teachings say that when they pass from that life, they sort of have a bit of like a mental body because mind continues on. Remember, many of those, I guess early Hinayana teachings said that mind was extinguished like a candle at that point. His Holiness has said, if that's the goal of your path, he says, why would you do that? Just to have everything cease. You know, so the mind continues on in a peaceful state, in the state of nirvana, until such time that a Buddha sort of stirs them out of that solitary peace and says, oh, guess what? You didn't do all the work yet. You got to go back to the Mahayana path and enter there and do all the work that the bodhisattvas do. Now, you want to do all the work because you've removed everything that afflicts the mind. You no longer have any delusions. You no longer have any contaminated karma. So then you have to enter into that path, cultivate bodhicitta, accumulate all the merit and the positive potential that allows you to become a Buddha. So it will take you longer to do all of that, to go through all of the Hinayana path, abide in that state of solitary peace, get stirred from that, enter the Mahayana, and go through all the collection of merit to become a Buddha, than it would from entering the Mahayana path from the very beginning. That's why if you have an inclination to the Mahayana path, best to enter it right from the beginning. Do what you can to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta, and then enter the Mahayana path, you know, achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible through that, rather than this more extensive path. Nonetheless, there are individuals, as I said, that the Buddha taught that path for. So we shouldn't have any disdain for that path, and we shouldn't have any negative feelings about that path. They compare it to people who, some people, you know, may not have the courage of heart to make a long journey on a boat. And say you want to get them to Island B, but Island A is between, a kind of a midpoint, where they can stop and think that they've, you know, made it there, and they can refresh themselves and kind of then make the rest of the journey. Well, that's how we can think about those individuals who have that inclination. They simply don't have the strength of will to make the full journey at this time. And when they attain their own liberation, they will be in perhaps even what might be a better position for them to make the longer journey. Whereas for us who are ready to go right to, you know, the island of enlightenment, well then get on that boat. You know, don't do the detour, because the detour will take you longer. Now again, I'm not speaking that from self-concern. We should once more always go back to that place. Why we don't want it to take longer is because others are going to suffer because we continue to be unenlightened. We can't help others to the degree that we would like to. And that's, of course, what funnels us even further into the tantric path, where it said you can achieve enlightenment in a single lifetime. Not a single finger snap, but a single lifetime. In a short period of a single lifetime, with all the causes and conditions. Milarepa, yeah, these great saints, you know, who have been able to attain that. Lama Tsongkhapa was said to attain that as he exited this life and went through the intermediate state and so on. The processes that happen there using tantric practices. So we can attain enlightenment much more quickly, but we have to do it with that pure motivation that really wants to be a benefit to others as quickly as possible. So bodhicitta is the foundation for the Mahayana, which includes the tantric path. Sometimes people think Vajrayana is something else. Well, Vajrayana is simply an extension of our Mahayana path. And in the Lam Rim, of course, you study up through the sutra teachings that are the doorway then for you to engage in the tantric path. The tantric teachings are rarely included in there. If they're in there, they're very brief. Tantra is kind of a separate path in its own way in terms of the practices, but it's simply an extension of the Mahayana, and it overlays the Mahayana in terms of your progress as you go through the paths and the grounds, the bhumis, and so on. So your question about arhats in particular, did I answer it yet, or do you still have an...
And then the bodhisattvas,
uh-huh.
Bhumis, what are all these?
The bhumis are the grounds.
Why can't we jump from first look right directly to the top?
I mean, it's kind of like anything. We always have to create the foundation for moving up to the next step. You know, if we look at Venerable Urbina frequently uses the idea, even with the Lam Rim, of like three different levels of schooling. You know, if you have a 5 or 6 year old and you say, I want you to go to college, well, you don't take them to University of North Carolina and say, here, I want my son or daughter to go to college. They're like, your kid's 5 years old, you know. So you let that 5 year old develop their qualities and abilities in doing the basic stuff that they need through grade school, and then you let them go to high school and develop all those qualities and understanding that are more advanced, and then they enter into university and they can do that deeper work. You don't take them right to university.
A prodigy.
Yeah, unless you've like done a lot of work in other lifetimes. You know? So for most of us, you know, we need that kind of gradual path. That's why the Lam Rim is taught. And that's why even the path to enlightenment, when it's taught in terms of these 5 paths, the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, the path of seeing, the path of meditation, the path of no more learning. I'm not going to go into a whole explanation of all this. Maybe the next time I come, I can do one little class on that. I did one in Taos. And people found it useful because it's sort of nice to know what the roadmap looks like. You know, you enter the path of accumulation with this uncontrived bodhicitta. That's how you become a bodhisattva. And then the rest of it is how that bodhisattva develops their mind all the way to enlightenment, which is the path of no more learning. You know, school's out at that point. You know, no more teachers, no more books. You know. Okay. So the bhumis, the grounds, are included within the path of seeing and the path of meditation, and they are what take you gradually through this process of removing all of the stuff that obscures your mind. Now remember, on the Hinayana path, you removed, those who do that path, they remove all the afflictive stuff, all of the delusions in the mind, everything that that supports, especially the ignorance that's at the root of that. The bodhisattva has to do that work first. So that's what they remove on the path of seeing and the first several grounds, all the way through the seventh ground, the seventh bhumi. And then they go on through the last three grounds to remove what are called the subtler obscurations in the mind, the obscurations to Buddhahood. Again, I don't want to get in too technical about all this. Is this helpful for people or are people?
If I could just ask you, so is pure, would you say, what are the most important things to do? Purification, perhaps, in meditation? His Holiness says that meditation is very important. I mean, how could we get there quickie?
Well, what is it that Lama Tsongkhapa was, he asked Manjushri, I think, what are the most important things to work on to become enlightened? And I think His Holiness, or Manjushri said, accumulate merit, purify negativities. I think he included those as one. The second one was something like, oh God, what is it? Somebody in the room must know this. The third one was make heartfelt requests to the guru, you know, recognizing the importance of guru devotion. The second one I thought was meditating on the Lam Rim, but I don't know for
meditating
sure.
Meditating on the Lam Rim.
I think it is meditating on the Lam Rim.
In one of the classes, Discovering Buddhism, the one about bodhicitta, in the blue book.
Uh-huh. The liberation in the palm of your hand.
That one, it says that what leads you faster to enlightenment is doing everything for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
Bodhicitta.
Yeah.
Like having that aspiration of you know, doing everything, your mind, your speech, and your actions.
Absolutely. And so I think that, again, all of these are part and parcel of whatever description we use for kind of how to get there, you know, what is the most effective way, is that obviously we're doing everything within the context of bodhicitta, because even all of our meditations on the small scope of the Lam Rim and the middle scope of the Lam Rim are done with bodhicitta. All of our other practices of accumulation and purification should be done with bodhicitta. So there's lots of these, again, this is how we actually kind of prepare ourselves to be able to enter that path and to engage fully and eventually become enlightened. Did you want to say something, Aaron? Or
I might have lost it, but just to, I kind of got a glimpse of what you're kind of explaining, the path of the Hinayana and the Mahayana, and I think what you were saying was that the Mahayana would develop bodhicitta first, but then entering these five paths have, like, some, I was trying to think about, well, wait, where does emptiness come into this? Because you wouldn't really be like you wouldn't be an arhat if you weren't seeing things clearly, but yet it seems, but in a Mahayana path that comes later.
Okay, so there's two tracks in a sense. You have the first track is the one who enters the Hinayana first and then has to enter the Mahayana to complete their work and become a Buddha. The second track is the one who enters the Mahayana first from the very beginning and then completes the path initially on that path, doesn't become an arhat, in other words, first and then enter the Mahayana. So for the person who's an arhat, they have realized emptiness, absolutely, because they've removed, again, all of what we call the afflictive obscurations, which are the ignorances that's at the root of all of our suffering, all the delusions that arise on the basis of that, all the contaminated karma is sort of disempowered by virtue of no longer having that ignorance, all the seeds of those afflictions, all of that is removed. What hasn't been removed yet, why you need to engage in the Mahayana path, and the work that the bodhisattva will do on the pure grounds at the very end is remove what are called the obscurations to omniscience. Now, what are those? Those are these imprints or latencies. By virtue of having had that ignorance for so long, we've kind of left stains in the mind that cause things to appear as if they exist inherently. Emptiness is the realization that they don't exist inherently, but we haven't yet gotten rid of that false appearance, and that false appearance is said to be what blocks us from knowing all phenomena. It acts as kind of like a barrier because it's a false appearance. It is something not appearing in the way that it exists. It's very hard to get our heads around these things because we're having them together at the same time. Things appear to be inherently existing and we grasp at them as inherently existing. The Hinayana path is only after getting rid of the grasping, and the appearance will still be there. The Mahayana path says, I need to get rid of both of these, especially this, because this is what keeps me from becoming a Buddha. But I have to get rid of this first. And so I'm going to get rid of that on the first 7 grounds, and then on the 8th, 9th, and 10th grounds, I'm going to get rid of this, and I'll become a Buddha. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense than it did previous to this conversation.
Okay.
Because I've been thinking a lot about the two wings, compassion and wisdom, and thinking of compassion as the method. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just what exactly that means, and that's a bigger conversation. But all of these thoughts that we're thinking about this whole weekend are, you know, have this bigger goal.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where what we're doing in the sutra path, which is mostly what I've been describing in terms of the bodhisattva's path, is that you are trying to use these two to strengthen each other. You know, you've got these two wings of the bird, and by virtue of the strength of our compassion, we then have more energy to engage in the wisdom, and we'll get deeper insights, and then by virtue of those deeper insights, we can strengthen our compassion, and we kind of go back and forth between these two. What's said in the Tantra path is that you're able to actually combine these two into one state of mind in the midst of deity yoga. Tantra is very complex because it's about bringing all these things into one state of mind as much as possible, because that's what a Buddha's mind is. Because once more, we're working with trying to bring the result of Buddhahood into the present moment, into the now, so we can accomplish enlightenment even more quickly. So these two, they're not completely separate by any means, even in the sutra path, because they're definitely working in tandem. As I said, when you realize emptiness to some degree, even conceptually have an understanding of emptiness, your compassion should increase because you see sentient beings as they're making just what some people call just a slight mistake. I mean, it's a huge mistake in terms of its ramifications, but we're not seeing things correctly, and by virtue of that, all of our suffering is happening. If we were able to correct that mistake, if sentient beings were able to have that wisdom, they would be free of all their suffering. So our compassion grows even greater because we feel so much more for sentient beings because we understand their suffering. Yeah. So,
Shravakas or Shravakayanas, are they arhats? I mean, if you could just put it, I wonder for so long.
Okay, so Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. These are two Sanskrit terms. They're frequently translated as hearers and solitary realizers. They are the two different types of practitioners on the Hinayana. Hearers are those who hear the Mahayana teachings but don't necessarily follow them, but they definitely are hearing the Buddha's teachings and engaging in a more sort of communal way of practicing. Solitary realizers might have some communal way of practicing, but in their last lifetime, they make prayers for that last lifetime to be one where they can achieve enlightenment in a solitary way or achieve arhatship in a solitary way.
Just for themselves,
but they have some compassion, His Holiness has pointed out, because they want to be born into a world in that last lifetime where there are no Buddhas, so that they can, through their becoming an arhat, demonstrate the Dharma in their own way, which they do in these kinds of wondrous ways. But anyway, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. but so know that you can have, like, hearer arhats and solitary realizer arhats, but they're both really just at the level of being an arhat. Neither one of them has done anything to damage the obstructions to omniscience. It's only bodhisattvas that do that through the power of their compassion and uniting their bodhicitta with that meditation on emptiness that allows them to accomplish that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
since we're going this route, I'm
not always, by choice, just so you know.
I can hold off.
No, it's okay.
I'm serious about that.
It's okay. Please go on, Dre.
Well,
I was just joking.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. DZO Dzogchen?
Dzogchen.
Dzogchen. You mentioned it before. I heard that Dzogchen is like, I think Surya Das said in Awaken the Buddha Within, that that is the quick path.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? I don't really want the quickest path, but I think we hurt ourselves that way, but I'm just wondering what. Yeah, I'm just curious.
So the short answer to that is, I don't really know, because I don't really... Dzogchen, most of you know that there are four Tibetan Buddhist traditions. What we practice here is the last that was formulated by virtue of Lama Tsongkhapa, who lived the late 14th, early 15th century, and it's come to be known as Gelugpa. The oldest tradition started in the 7th, 8th century with Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava, Guru Padmasambhava, who brought the Buddha Dharma to Tibet initially, and it's called the Nyingma. Nyingma means the ancient ones, and they mostly are the practitioners of Dzogchen, and that's where it's taught. There are some Gelugpa guys like Alan Wallace and what have you that seem to have a strong interest in Dzogchen, and I even knew some Gelugpa students who seem to be gravitating more towards that. They're all different ways of approaching the path. I can't speak to their efficacy or what they are comparable to or how quick they are or whatever the case might be, because I don't really know much about those. I started in a Nyingma tradition, but I only spent a few years and can't say I studied it extensively. Dzogchen, in some ways, as I hear about it, is similar to Mahamudra, which is another technique of realizing emptiness. His Holiness, when I heard him teach on Dzogchen in France in, I don't know what year it was, 2001 or 2, something like that, he said that whatever the people are doing in Dzogchen, they have to be realizing emptiness or they can't be achieving the realizations and the progress on the path. So at some level, whether you're using Dzogchen to realize it, whether you're using just a meditation on emptiness that's just working in the ways that we teach in this tradition, or whether you're using Mahamudra, or whether you're using Tantra, you're realizing the same emptiness. And Tantra is taught as the highest practice in this tradition, and Tantra is also taught in all the other Tibetan Buddhist traditions, but they seem to have also a reliance upon Dzogchen and Mahamudra and other practices, and I can't really speak so much to those. Mahamudra is taught in Gelugpa, but by that they frequently are meaning just using the mind as a basis for realizing emptiness, not seeing the conventional nature of the mind, but the ultimate nature of the mind. Okay.
So I don't need a thorough answer to this, so I was not aware that a Hinayana practitioner would have to go back and take the Mahayana path. Now, I feel that in my current condition in this lifetime, I do not have the capacity to deal with Tantra. If I keep following the Mahayana path, will someone grab me back and say, you got to do the Tantra too?
Well, so again, there may be, as I understand it, there might be some misunderstanding there, because once more, when we talk about the Mahayana path, it has an extension into the tantric path, into Vajrayana. And it's actually said in the Gelugpa teachings, it's actually said that you have to practice Tantra eventually to become enlightened. Oh, you shouldn't have that
it's
thought.
Okay. In one of my other lives, I'll have
it. Oh, good. I'll get an opportunity in a future lifetime.
No, it's terrific. When I'm not ADHD in another lifetime, I'm going to nail it.
Yeah. No, I don't mean that to be a discouragement in any way, because I think what we have to recognize is that, just to have the full understanding that what Tantra does, and let me, God, this gets to be a complicated answer. Tantra has the ability to help remove obscurations at the subtlest level. Now, I remember how I just talked about these two different levels of obscuration, the afflictive obscurations and the knowledge obscurations. Well, the reality is that those two are still what Tantra is getting rid of, but we're talking about them in even subtler states of mind. You've probably have heard of these subtler states that you go through in death. the mind of white appearance, red increase, black near attainment, and then eventually clear light mind. Well, the three that precede clear light mind are all subtle levels of conceptual thought. And you have states of mind that are attached to inherent existence and so on that are connected with those. For you to remove those, you can't stay at a coarser level of mind. You have to use the mind of clear light. And that's why the aim in Tantra is to induce the mind of clear light, or use it at the time of death, as an entryway for you to realize emptiness and to achieve Buddhahood through your practice of deity yoga and so on. And it's quite complicated beyond there. But just know that we have to practice the sutra path as well. It's not like, you know, anything we're doing is wasted, and it's not wasted. Everything we do on the sutra path will ripen into our meeting the tantric path. Make strong prayers that you continue to meet precious gurus and that you continue to generate all the realizations that are needed to get you to the tantric path to be able to become enlightened. No problem. This lifetime, next lifetime, 10 lifetimes from now, 1,000 lifetimes from now, you know. So, I mean, I'm not, again, trying to share that knowledge to discourage anyone anyway, just to understand that according to the Gelugpa teachings, we do have to eventually practice Tantra to do the deepest work to be able to become fully enlightened. It said even Shakyamuni Buddha, who was able to remove all of these down to the subtlest level, you know, still couldn't remove the subtler ones because needed to practice Tantra and needed to go to a pure land to be able to do that. Yeah, you can do it in a pure land. I think you have pretty ideal conditions in the pure lands. Rinpoche's been kind of pushing the pure lands a lot. Venerable Rabina, when she's teaching, she's always like, I'm going to Amitabha's pure land. I'm going there. So I kind of feel like I'm going to grab her coattails and her robe tails. She can help skate me into enlightenment through the pure land. So anyway, God, I've talked about a lot of things. Wasn't kind of intending, yeah, this to be a Q&A on a lot of stuff, but
sorry, well,
since I'm here, I
gentle.
Guess this is my role. do I? How many of you know these techniques for developing bodhicitta? Does everyone know these techniques? Kinda, sorta. Okay. We only have a 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Well, forget it. Okay, so. Yeah, it's really hard to cover this in a short period of time, and we're doing Sulk shortly after this, so what I think might be best is this whole section, you know, there's some wonderful teachings that exist that you can go through to fully explore both of these techniques. The first technique that's on the top of page, it's kind of the introduction is the bottom of page 6, the sevenfold cause and effect technique, and it continues on the top of page 7. That one is a bit more about recognizing sentient beings as our mothers and feeling this closeness to them and then wanting to benefit them and then generating love and compassion and then eventually saying, and I have to become a Buddha for their sake and so on. The other one is the technique that involves Tonglen, and we didn't get into the whole questions around Tonglen and that, but Tonglen is a very powerful practice where we're kind of targeting this self-cherishing mind, this self-centeredness, and trying to overcome it initially by equalizing ourselves with others and then eventually exchanging ourselves with others, meaning that the way we normally think of me being most important, I'm going to hold others to be most important and relegate myself to a lower position, not because I'm unworthy, but because this is the way I actually achieve my greatest welfare once more. This is how I'm wisely selfish, is by attending to the needs of others. So these techniques are taught extensively. Trying to think of what would be a good go-to book. Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand touches on them, but in the middle of equalizing and exchanging self and others is the whole 7-point cause and effect and all this, or 7-point mind training. Goes into a whole lot of different teachings. So maybe some of the teachings from Discovering Buddhism are nice. The one by River Rinpoche, Gyabji River Rinpoche, that's called How to Generate Bodhicitta. That's a very nice one. If you've taken module 10 or have any aspiration, you just concluded that one, didn't you, recently? Yeah. So anyway, there is probably in the library even the little booklet of that by River Rinpoche that's called How to Generate Bodhicitta. Do you know if that's out there?
I don't know. It was a PDF. We can only find a PDF.
I think there's a PDF, and it is out at lamayeshe.com or whatever, Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives. Yeah. Okay. So know that there's very nice teachings out there. The ones by Kyabje River Rinpoche, I think, are really, really special, and he kind of covers all these points. But know that a measurable equanimity, as you can see, it kind of fits as the platform, the basis for how we begin that practice, by understanding that all beings are the same as us, and all beings are, we need to have a more kind of equal mind with regard to them and not have such bias and partiality. Then we begin to contemplate these thoughts about them in the first one, about them being our mothers and so on, reflect on their kindness, and then we can, from that, generate love. And the technique for generating love in here is not that different from immeasurable love. It's essentially the same, as is the technique for generating compassion. And then, of course, joy fits in more as like the joy that comes along as we meditate on all of these. It's not really explicitly taught in the techniques. Equanimity, compassion, and love are in the other technique as well, and you can just identify where those are. Compassion and love mostly come into play with Tonglen, with this very, as I said, it's kind of, I call it a visceral practice, because it is really about feeling compassion and love in a much deeper way. It's not just thoughts of it, it's actually being willing to take on the suffering of others, being willing to give away what you have for others to be happy. And then generating joy upon the thought of having done that, and that's a measurable joy to some degree. So these four measurable thoughts are definitely, sometimes they even refer to them as the way in which you moisten the mind so that bodhicitta can grow and develop. It's a bit like that prayer from Long Chengpa, you know, that speaks to the ways in which our full awakening can bloom from all of that. The last thing I want to point out before we leave today is what's on page 8 at the top, which is Rinpoche's advice for how you practice Tonglen while reciting the Four Immeasurables. This is a really powerful way to do this. So with the prayer for cultivating immeasurable equanimity, which we had on handout number 1, it's also, I say handout number 1, I meant session number 1. I didn't change all that. Normally when I teach you those different sessions and they have different handouts. But you could just use this sheet. So the very first one, equanimity, you meditate briefly on taking all the disturbing emotions of sentient beings and giving them to your self-cherishing thought. So it's the taking part of it. Because we want all sentient beings to not have attachment, hatred, indifference, you know, bias. And then with the prayer for cultivating immeasurable love, we transform our body into a wish-granting jewel that gives every sentient being every kind of temporal and ultimate happiness that they desire and need. So you become the source of that for others. This is what Tonglen is all about. I'm going to take all of your suffering and give you happiness. Take the delusions, give away everything that brings well-being. And you do the same with the next two. With compassion, you take away all the causes of suffering, all the sufferings of others. And then with immeasurable joy, you give all your own merits of the past, present, and future and their results, including enlightenment, to all sentient beings. So that's Lama Zopa's advice on how to practice the Four Immeasurables, incorporating Tonglen, kind of making it, again, much more powerful in that way. And then as I say there to conclude, just before the addendum number 1, is you can also use the special bodhicitta prayer at the conclusion of the meditation on bodhicitta and prior to engaging in your daily practices. In particular, I must achieve enlightenment quickly in order to free all the numberless kind mother sentient beings from the unimaginable oceans of samsaric suffering and causes of suffering and lead them to peerless full enlightenment. For this purpose, I'm going to undertake the practice of Genrezig, Green Tara, whatever it is that you're going to do. These are Rinpoche's words that kind of help us to take that bodhicitta and move it into whatever it is that we're going to do. So how these would be practiced then, as if it's not obvious yet, is you would certainly start with just going through these four immeasurables, trying to cultivate them as a way to kind of moisten your mind. Maybe that's even before you've taken refuge. And then you channel them into your bodhicitta motivation, and you can do the full meditation on this if you have the time for that, and then you bring that meditation into, or that motivation of bodhicitta into your practice, and then you would recite all the prayers of elements of your practice. Sounds like a lot, right? Well, then do what you can. I mean, initially, it might just be, oh, I'm just going to recite the immeasurable thoughts and not maybe do extensive meditation. And then I'm just going to say the prayer of bodhicitta and not do much more than that. That's okay. But know that we have to put some attention into all these various elements. Why these are all taught is because they're all important. I know people often have that. What should I start with or what should I do? I can't answer that for everybody, but I think we have to acknowledge that if something is taught, it's important. It's an important part of what we're trying to engage in. So be kind to yourself and gentle with your practice, but nonetheless, you know, do something. Work with it as best as you can. Maybe what you can do in terms of some practice advice might be to work with one of the four immeasurables at a time and maybe do more extensive meditation on that one day or a couple of days. And then just recite the other ones and then go on to the next one for another several days or a week and then the next one. So some of them you would do in brief and some of them you would do much longer. This is frequently how teachers I've had have said to engage in your practice. You become more familiar with the various elements. For us to do a full meditation on any of these things would probably take our whole day, really, if we were to do it quite intensively. All the points that I've covered, trying to bring it all to mind, trying to work with it all. And I'm not sure anyone in the room has a whole day to meditate most days, you know. So find a way that works for you to be able to introduce it gradually. Work with just components of it. Don't feel like you have to bite off the whole thing and chew it all at once. Any questions or comments before we conclude today? You guys have been great. I'm serious. This has been really enjoyable for me, and don't get me wrong, I appreciate all the questions, and I, you know, they're good questions, and I'm glad to be here to be able to answer some of them too, and you know, provide what insights I can from the study that I've done. But I owe everything that I offer to you to my teachers, and I'm in great debt to them. So I hope you benefited from what they had to share with me that I've been able to share with you, and I wish you well in your practice. So. Shall we do dedication? Let's go. I like to do page 235, the two prayers there. I think those are really powerful prayers to reconnect with our motivation of bodhicitta that we had at the beginning of this session in particular, but throughout the weekend. This powerful mind that wants to become a Buddha for the sake of others. The first prayer on 235 is where we make that strong wish that everything that we've done, all the thoughts we've had, all the words we've shared, all of this become the cause for our own enlightenment and the enlightenment of all beings. And then the second prayer that we'll recite as well is that very deep aspiration that bodhicitta and all the accompanying thoughts that precede it develop very deeply in our own hearts and in the hearts of all beings, because this is the way for us to accomplish ultimate happiness for all beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. And let's go to page 244, where we have some of the brief long life prayers for our teachers. And as I've been pointing out, when we recite these prayers, we can think about the individuals in particular that we're praying for, these amazing beings. But we can also think about all spiritual guides, not just those in our tradition, you know, not being so kind of sectarian about it, but rather thinking about all those who are dedicated to helping others to be free from suffering, who are guiding them spiritually in Buddhism as well as all other spiritual traditions, that all have their own truths that they are offering to others, all have compassion at the core of their teachings. So may we and others continue to be guided by perfect guides in all of our lifetimes through reciting these prayers. Begin with the one with for His Holiness. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. all-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. 245 at the bottom. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. Back to the other side for Rinpoche. You who behold, uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And as we did at the end of this morning, also send out this positive energy to the beings whose situation moves you right now. And it may be beings that you know in your life who have obstacles or illness, who are dying or who have died, but it can also be those who we've heard of, people in various parts of the world that are undergoing great difficulty. And just send this positive energy out freely, giving it away to them so that they can achieve a relief of their happiness, complete freedom, a relief of their suffering, and complete happiness. And feel that they've truly attained that through what we've done here today. And may all beings attain true peace and happiness through all of our efforts. Okay, thank you all so much. Appreciate it.